In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with Dr. Mel Levine. He's professor of pediatrics at University of North Carolina Med School. He's also director of the university's Clinical Center for the Study of Development and Learning. And he has now become maybe one of the country's best-known writers and speakers on the subject of learning and how it is that different children are different, have different styles of learning, different kind of challenges they face, and how when we try to help them to learn, both as teachers and parents, we have to keep that in mind. He's written a book on that subject, really making the point of the differences between children, and that book is titled A Mind at a Time. His most recent book is now out in paperback. It's titled The Myth of Laziness. Children who don't perform well in school sometimes are accused of being lazy. And in this book, he makes the argument that, in fact, almost no one is actually lazy. He says the real problem here is something that he calls output failure, which can be traced to a number of factors. They can be biological, they can be neurological or psychological. And these things, he argues, can be both a problem for children and adults. So if you're interested in these things, you can go out and take a look at his books. They're both in paperback. They're published by Simon & Schuster. He's been with us before on the program, and when we got the opportunity again, because the response to his appearances here before had been so good, people really liked what he had to say, we said, yeah, we'd be happy to have him back on the program again. In addition to his work as a teacher and writer, he is also the co-founder of All Kinds of Minds. That is a nonprofit institute. It's devoted to the study of differences in learning. They have a website, by the way, allkindsofminds.org, if you're interested in taking a look at that. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, the questions and comments are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Dr. Levine, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's a pleasure, David.
I certainly appreciate it. One of the things that I think now is becoming a more and more commonly understood idea is this idea that all children are different, they learn differently, they have different styles and different challenges, and when it comes down to things that we as parents can do or that teachers can do, your approach needs to be tailored to the child. And I think now we're to the point where almost we've started to move away from using the term learning disability.
Right.
Because we think that it's a bad label that stigmatizes kids and it doesn't really describe very well what's going on. And I guess I wonder what you think about that and whether, in fact, it is right, that is the right approach, and maybe we should forget that term.
Well, I'm hoping we can stop labeling kids altogether. You know, labels oversimplify a kid. They make a child grow up feeling deviant, feeling somehow pathological or abnormal. And I think we're in a position where we can be much more specific with kids, so that instead of giving him some kind of D label, LD or ADD, we can say, you know, you're a really smart kid, but you have trouble expressing yourself. You have so many good ideas, you just can't get them out into words. And the fact that it's hard for you to figure out how to say things has made it also tough for you to write. And that's much more specific than saying you have LD, because then you can go on and say, now we can figure out how to make you talk better, how to help you to talk better, and what you can do to build up your talking muscles so you can become a better speaker and a better writer. And that's a much more constructive thing than to just write them off with a label.
I do wonder whether in the pursuit of what's right for each child, we have also made things a lot more difficult for teachers, because we have teachers who maybe have something between 20 and 30 students that they're trying to teach. And if we say to them, now remember, every kid is different and your approach to every child must be different, the teacher will say, but I can't possibly do that.
Right. You know, I don't think we're really saying you have to treat every child differently. And you have to have a completely different educational plan for every kid in your classroom. That obviously would be impossible and absurd. What we're really saying is be aware of the differences and try to incorporate them in your teaching, and you're probably going to find out that teaching actually becomes easier. But imagine a child who has trouble getting things out of his memory very quickly. He has what we call retrieval memory problems and lives in constant fear of being called on in class. He's just terrified that he's going to get called on. There's a good chance that kid's going to develop behavior problems. and sort of come out fighting. And that's what really will take a lot of the teacher's time.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if she knows that Georgie has retrieval memory problems, and she can go up to him and say, "George, I'm not going to call on you in class because I know you have these memory problems. But anytime you think you know an answer, why don't you volunteer?" And if she also could say, "George, I'm going to call on you tomorrow to tell us about the causes of World War One. Can you be ready for that?" Ordinarily, when you're called on in class, you have 3 seconds to respond. In this case, we're giving him 23 hours. You've accommodated them. That doesn't mean you have to have a whole separate lesson plan for that child. If you know a kid has trouble with sequencing, can't remember things in the right order, these kids who have trouble with sequencing have a terrible time doing cursive writing because that's the most complex sequence of all. Just think about it. When you're writing in cursive, first I have to make an M and go up and go down and come across and then go up to make an A and then come around and down to the bottom again. It's a huge drain on what we call sequential memory, memory for sequences. It really doesn't cost any money out of the school budget to tell that kid he should print from now on instead of doing cursive. So you see what I mean?
Yeah.
We're sort of meeting kids halfway. We're not totally radically treating them all differently, but we're preventing a lot of behavior problems. We're saving schools money because then the kid may not have to go out for special education, and we're redeeming someone who might feel terrible about himself.
Hmm. Well, acknowledging that labeling can be really... It can be not good for children, not good for their families. You also recommend that it's a good idea for parents, if they think that their children are having particular kinds of difficulties, to actually have an evaluation, to
right.
have a professional to talk with the child and kind of see, you can figure out what's going on.
Right.
How do you approach that kind of thing so that that can be a positive experience and can be useful for both?
Well, first of all, I think it should come away from an evaluation feeling terrific about himself, saying, "Yeah, I used to think I'm retarded. Now I know I'm having some problems with my memory or trouble finding words, or I have trouble getting my fingers to move right when I write. And I used to think I was completely dumb." So it should really be sort of liberating and rejuvenating for a kid to understand himself for the first time and realize it's not as bad as he thought it was. But I think parents, before going for an evaluation, have to come up with some good questions. It's one reason I wrote the books I've been writing, is because I want parents to be better informed. I want a parent to be able to say to a psychologist or somebody else who evaluates a child, "Excuse me, can you show me how you ruled out an expressive language problem in my child? Or tell me what you did to make sure he's not having trouble with long-term memory." So I think we ought to ask much more specific questions based on what you're seeing as a parent on a day-to-day basis with your child.
Our guest is Dr. Mel Levine. He's a pediatrician. He's professor of pediatrics at University of North Carolina Med School. He's also director of the university's Clinical Center for the Study of Development and Learning. And he is well known for writing and speaking about learning. And he is the author of a couple of books we've mentioned, and I want to mention them again because I think that parents would find them very useful, and they're both available in paperback, so they're not terribly expensive. One is A Mind at a Time, and the other, the most recent, is The Myth of Laziness, and they're both published by Simon & Schuster. Should be in the bookstore or in the library. In any case, you might want to take a look at them. And here, of course, on the program, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. And also, we do have that toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. Maybe we talk about the myth of laziness, and
right.
and the idea that indeed laziness, you know, that's a term we toss around pretty carelessly. And in mm-hmm. fact, as you say in the book, that probably most people, if they're having difficulty, and whether we're talking about children or adults, it's not laziness. There is some real thing going on that we ought to be aware of.
That's right, David. You know, I think everybody wants to be productive. I think every child and every adult wants to have output that brings in praise, that makes you feel good and effective. So when somebody is not producing, when a kid is not doing homework, when an adult is not really doing the job on the job, then we can say, where's the breakdown occurring? What's happening along that person's assembly line that's obstructing output, that's obstructing that natural inclination to be a productive person? Where's the breakdown occurring? And if we take a close look, we find it every time, so much so that I don't think there's any such thing as a lazy person. I mean, we all have lazy moments, but for a person to be deemed lazy, I think, is a very superficial and unhelpful way of thinking.
Well, you list in the book a number of specific things.
Right.
Issues that have to do with everything from being able to be verbally fluent, well, I have sometimes trouble with that myself, difficulties in memory, difficulties in just maintaining the kind of mental energy that's involved in seeing something through from beginning to end, a number of major areas.
Right.
And it could be one or maybe more than one of these things.
That's correct. You know, so, for example, in childhood, we have a really wonderful window on output. It's called what you can get down on paper. Writing is a very interesting indicator of productivity in kids, at least academic productivity. And we see kids who have output problems because they can't get thoughts on paper. Some of them have what we call graphomotor dysfunction. It's a big word, but it means they have trouble getting their muscles to move right during writing. So letter formation is a struggle for them, and they often have an awkward pencil grip, strange way of holding the pencil. Their handwriting may be barely legible, but more than anything else, it's just taking too much effort on their part. So they end up hating to write. They may be resistant to doing homework as a result, and they demonstrate output failure because of that motor blockage during writing. Other kids are lacking the memory capacity for it. They just can't remember enough for writing. And you have to realize that when you're a kid, absolutely nothing takes more memory than writing. You have to simultaneously recall letter formation, spelling, punctuation, grammar, capitalization, facts, vocabulary, the assignment, your own ideas. And if you don't have a big enough memory cable going from your brain down to your fingers, you're going to stop doing homework. And then we see both adults and kids who have trouble with output because they're incredibly disorganized. Either they can't organize time, or they can't organize materials, or they can't put together the multiple moving parts that exist in a project they have to do. They just can't seem to get things together and integrate them. We have some people who have trouble with what I call step wisdom. It's a weird word, step wisdom. It means they don't seem to know how to look at a task and break it down into manageable steps. So they feel overwhelmed when they try to do something because they can't sort of break it down into its pieces, into steps that they can swallow. So we have this wide range of possibilities, a language issue, a memory issue, a mental energy issue, a motor issue, that could be blocking output. And I think we have to give people the benefit of the doubt and say they'd like to produce, but something's getting in the way. And then the question is, what is it? And what do we do about it?
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Someone who is on a cell phone on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I really strongly agree with your position of declassifying students and treating them individually. I think that, in fact, that is much more time effective, as you've indicated, than trying to deal with classes of people. And I just wanted to point out, and I know you're aware of this, that we're not only talking about people who might have learning disabilities at that end of the spectrum, but also people who are gifted or who have a very fast ability to learn. The kids that you have to say, I can see that you're bored. Maybe you need to go and study this. You know, while the rest of the class is doing this, you go a little bit farther ahead, and or you're raising your hand all the time. Why don't you just raise it a little bit so I'll know, but I'm not going to be able to call on you because I know you know the answer.
Right.
And I just remember going to grade school and getting A's with unsatisfactory for effort, but I never understood what that meant. And my parents didn't care because I got the A.
Right.
It was something the teacher was expecting. And I think particularly now that we're understanding that we have not only one difficulty called autism, but we also have Asperger's syndrome. And they're basically on the opposite end of the spectrum, but it's really more of a circle. Right. And that's what we have to do, is just look at each kid and deal with them that way. I just wanted to make that comment that I agree with you very much. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. You want to say anything more about that, Dr. Levine?
No, it's just that I really do think the labels aren't helpful and they don't emphasize your strengths enough. And even calling someone gifted, I have some problematic issues with that to say somebody is really brilliant and a genius, I would say, let me at him. I'll tell you what his weaknesses are.
Mm. Well, you can certainly imagine that you could have somebody who would be gifted or be very bright or, you know, whatever word you want to use, and yet have some of these kinds of difficulties that we've talked about. For
Absolutely.
Example, you know, someone could be brilliant, but they could be really disorganized.
Absolutely.
And have trouble with those same sorts of tasks.
Yeah, absent-minded professor.
Yeah. And not be able to use their full potential for just those same very things.
Yeah, and they can exasperate their teachers or parents because they seem so brilliant, but they're just not producing commensurate with what we know their intelligence is.
Are all of these things, do you think, one way or another, the result of essentially the way people's brains are wired?
I think to a large extent they are. But they can also be influenced by environment, by your culture, by the kind of education you've received, by your own personality. So I think a lot of factors can shape these things. But, you know, any parent who has three kids at home can tell you how different they are in the way they learn and in the way they seem to function. Even though they're brought up in the same household with the same parents and the same life experiences, there can be enormous variation even within a family. It's partly genetic, partly environmental, partly cultural, partly medical, but mostly mysterious why someone is wired the way that she's wired.
Some of these things that you were talking about before, that is that children or adults can have different kinds of difficulties. Either we can
right.
talk about memory issues or verbal fluency or just
right.
the maintaining the kind of mental energy it takes to see a task through or
right.
the issue of organization. It would seem to me that some of these things might be a little bit more easy to deal with, that it might be an easier thing, for example, to coach someone on being more organized
right.
or how to break a task down into discrete steps so it makes it easier to do it and
right.
it doesn't seem quite so overwhelming, that might be a little bit more of a practical issue. And when you're dealing with other sorts of things, motor issues, memory issues, maybe also lack of verbal fluency, that there it seems that it's much more, what we're looking at is something much more difficult because it is maybe a little bit more a matter of internal wiring than it simply
right.
is of being organized or being able to break things down into recognizable pieces and deal with it.
You know, David, that's such a crucial question. How malleable are we? To what extent can we change the way someone's wired or improve the way someone's mm-hmm. wired? And in an individual case, it can be very hard to know, even with organizational skills. I have a patient of mine who's about 18 or 19 years old. He came to see me recently, really nice kid who's totally disorganized, and he said, "Dr. Levine, I have taken so many classes on study skills and organizational skills that I'm ready to go teach them." He said, "I just don't happen to use any of them myself." So you can sort of lead an animal to the trough, but you can't make him drink out of it. And sometimes there's a big distance between a kid understanding what he needs to do and then actually doing it. We see it all the time. I mean, people can understand that they need to stop smoking. That doesn't mean they're going to stop smoking.
Well, with that with that particular case, do you think that it really truly was a case that there was some reason that he was resistant, or that the kinds of coaching that he had gotten just didn't work for him, or that somehow one still could find the right approach, and you just have to say to yourself, well, if we just found the right way to put it to the guy, he would say, oh yeah, I see, okay, and then start doing it.
All of the above. You wonder whether he had the right kind of teaching. You wonder whether there's still a better kind. You also wonder whether at some point in life he'll be ready for it. There's something called readiness for help. And if you try to help someone and they're not ready to accept help, you're probably wasting your time. So there's a kind of state of mind of saying, yeah, I really want to do something about these organizational problems. And I'm not sure this kid was that motivated to do anything about him. He was pretty happy with the way his life was going in a disorganized fashion. And then I think there are some people for whom, for example, organization just doesn't feel right. It doesn't come naturally to them. It doesn't fit with their temperament and personality and orientation in life. They really like having a messy desk. And they feel most comfortable, you know, in chaos. But it can take its toll on their output.
This touches on maybe another point that maybe isn't important to make, is that the kinds of things that here we're talking about, they're not just things that you see in children. It seems that if these are the sort of difficulties that people have when they are children, it seems that as they grow up and become adults, these things don't go away. They may learn to cope with them, and they may adopt skills to live their life successfully, even though they have those issues. But it sounds as if those things don't go away and may indeed continue to dog people into their adulthood.
Yeah, they can come back as little leitmotifs throughout your life, recurring themes in a sense. But a lot of people improve tremendously. For example, there are adults who are very verbal, very good at communicating, and never were at all good with language when they were kids. And they really focused on it, and they really concentrated on speaking well and speaking in full sentences. And little by little, that language ability improved significantly. And you know how this often happens? It's really quite interesting, David. People will sometimes develop their language abilities within an area of passion. Let's pretend there's some kid who loves sports. Well, the way to build his language abilities is to have him talk as much sports talk as possible and elaborate on the ball game he saw the other night. And very often your area of passion, your area of strong interest, your niche, is the place in which you get organized. It's interesting. I've taken care of a lot of kids over the years who've become chefs in restaurants. And they're very disorganized in their daily lives and totally organized in the kitchen. I mean, you can't be a chef in a big restaurant without being organized.
No, you can't.
So within their domain, they can get their acts together, while other parts of their life may not be responding.
We are at our midpoint, and I just would like to introduce again our guest, Dr. Mel Levine. He is a pediatrician. He's professor of pediatrics at University of North Carolina Med School. He's also director of the university's Clinical Center for the Study of Development and Learning, and is the author of several books on learning, and two that I have mentioned. They're both available now in paperback. One is A Mind at a Time, and the other, the more recent, is The Myth of Laziness, and they're both published by Simon & Schuster, and they're not terribly expensive, so if you're interested in taking a look at them, if you have children, I think that you'd find a lot in them. They're out there in the bookstore at the library. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. What sort of things do you do to try to help people who have memory difficulties?
Well, let me give you an example. Basically, what we try to do is take some of the strain off memory. Let's say there's a child who hates to write because he just can't access all those memory pathways at the same time, you know, to remember spelling and punctuation and vocabulary and the assignment and his own ideas and facts and stuff. He just can't access all that stuff simultaneously. Well, then we try to have him write in stages. And I might say, Billy, why don't you just brainstorm tonight and write down a lot of good ideas, and don't worry about punctuation, and don't worry about your spelling, we'll do that some other time. And by breaking it down into stages, without asking him to remember everything all at once, he suddenly is able to write. We might also want to give him some leeway on the memory part of writing. A teacher might say, look, don't worry about spelling this week, it's not a priority, just get your ideas, and we'll work on spelling another time. But these kids can't do all these things at once. They can't remember spelling, punctuation, grammar, capitalization. So to give them a waiver on one during an assignment. Another thing that helps memory a lot is using a computer. Because in a way, what a computer is just some more memory that you take on board. And the computer will remember how to make an H, and then you don't have to. Spell check, for example, is another good memory aid for kids. So computers have done a lot to help children who have memory problems that are making it hard for them to write.
Let's talk with another caller. We have someone here, also a cell phone caller here on our line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Just a comment and a question. I'm 60 years old. I'm a school psychologist and a behavior analyst, and I'm a terribly disorganized person. But it's never worried me too much because I always knew where everything was. And so though my office looks like chaos, I always thought it was wasted up because it used to do. Now that I'm getting to this age and my memory's not quite as good as it was, I think I'm going to have to learn skills. That I'll go.
You're kind of breaking up on us.
Behind.
Well, maybe I can just say a word based on what he said.
Sure.
I think you can have a messy office and be well organized, if you know where everything is. So the outward appearance of disorganization may not really be true disorganization. If you meet deadlines, if you can find things, if you have what you need when you need it, then you're organized. You're not terribly tidy, but you're organized.
I guess the issue is, can you do the work that you need to do the way that you do it? And if the answer is yes, well, then maybe that's okay. If the answer is no, then maybe the issue is, well, let's
if somebody,
do something about it.
Is very absent-minded, but you can really depend on them to get a job done, and they meet deadlines, and the work is of high quality, then the absent-mindedness isn't getting in the way. It's just a kind of feature of that person.
Yeah. It occurs to me that part of the problem may be, or part of the difficulty, I think, sometimes, particularly for children in school situations, does have to do with pressure to perform under a very tight deadline, perhaps.
Right.
Or, as you say, it's the matter of the teacher calls on a child, and he or she has about 3 seconds to come up with an answer, and that probably almost anybody will find it difficult to perform under that situation, and that means that you need to try to find ways to try to take the pressure off, not only in the classroom, but perhaps here is a place that parents can really be involved and try to work on some of those issues away from school, in the home, and do it, though particularly do it, in a low-pressure kind of atmosphere.
Absolutely, and I think we educators and educational policymakers have to take a new look at this whole time issue in school. In my opinion, all tests should be untimed. The SATs should be untimed for everybody. And in fact, kids ought to be rewarded for taking more time doing things. What we want to do is produce a whole generation of kids who know how to work carefully and slowly and deliberatively, and we're almost encouraging them to be impulsive. I mean, if I were a history teacher in 10th grade, I would give kids all the time they want to write their essay, but tell them they're only allowed to write 2 pages. And it makes much more sense to limit space than to limit time. If you go into journalism, your editor's going to tell you how long the article can be, but he doesn't care if you spend an hour and a half or 20 minutes on it, as long as it's good. So I think constantly requiring kids to work very fast under timed conditions is not really preparing them for anything. I don't know what a time multiple choice test does for your mind. That's at all applicable in the adult world.
I think that it was the last caller. Unfortunately, his call kind of broke up on us, and I think, though, he wanted to ask your thoughts about the No Child Left Behind legislation. And it was something that I actually wanted to ask about, too,
right,
because it's been something that the president has pointed to as something that he feels is a success, this legislation that says to schools, we're going to demand that you demonstrate student performance, there's going to be accountability, and that then federal assistance is going to be hinged on that. It's been very controversial because some people on the other end in schools are saying, you know, that's really not helpful, it's not the way to go, and in fact, there's been some question about here and there whether schools, in order to meet the standards set by the government, they're clipping off the kids who are not performing. That's they're just not counting their scores, and so some people are saying, you know, it's not really doing what we say that it's there to do. And I wonder what you think about all of that.
Yeah, I've seen the phenomenon you mentioned last, where a school will actually take its kids with learning problems out of the mainstream and only test the ones who are doing reasonably well and report those scores. They'll sort of exile some of the students into resource rooms or something and find a way of not including them in the test data. But I think the No Child Left Behind legislation has some benefits to it. It's good to hold schools accountable. It's good to make sure that children are acquiring skills, and unfortunately that requires testing. But as everyone says, we wish we didn't have to test, but it's hard to come up with a better alternative for really keeping people accountable. On the other hand, I think we have to be really careful that we're not hurting kids with the No Child Left Behind. I find it a little paradoxical to say we have legislation called No Child Left Behind, but if you don't pass the end of grade testing at third grade, we're going to leave you behind.
Yeah.
In third grade, isn't that a contradiction? It seems to me if you don't pass the testing, then we're not going to leave you behind and humiliate you, knowing that grade retention is one of the most humiliating experiences a kid can endure. If you don't pass the third grade testing, we're going to help you. We're going to intervene actively to make sure that you improve your reading rather than punish you by retaining you in a grade. I also think we need to realize that you can't evaluate every kid the same way. Some kids don't test well, but they know more than you think. And we have to look at different kinds of minds and the best way to get at what they know and what they can do. It's also the case that we should offer some alternatives to testing, some other ways that kids can demonstrate their output and their accomplishments. So I think what I'm saying is that if No Child Left Behind is to continue, we need to build in safeguards so we're not hurting certain kids. And we also need to be careful that teachers are not teaching to the test, that they've given up all other aspects of teaching, and the whole educational mission is to make sure your kids do well on the testing, which means a lot of important parts of school will no longer be taught because they're not on the test. And that would be a real shame, and we're hearing some teachers complaining about that as well. In fact, if I were the czar of education, I would not test every school every year. I would do it randomly, and I would make sure people don't know when the testing's going to be done. And I would try to make sure that it be almost illegal to prepare kids for the test.
Hmm. All right.
So
well,
tests just come and go, and that's that.
We have some other callers to bring in. Let's go to the next in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of very interesting comments. I agree with a lot of what you said about the whole the child, no child left behind, and as a parent, I appreciate so many teachers who I think are working really, really hard, and it seems fairly unrealistic to expect that every child will perform the same on a standardized test or perform,
right,
you know, to the expectation. So there's a lot of concerns there. But
Let me mention one other point, which is that we need to keep a close eye on the dropout rate.
Yes.
Because there have been some places where the testing has been in place, and people feel pretty good about accountability, and the dropout rate in high school has increased. Kids are just getting discouraged and dropping out of school.
Mm-hmm. From what I understand, the thing of not timing on testing, that I know that there are some areas or some school districts near the Houston area that had unlimited time to take those tests, and I think it would be interesting to compare, do some comparison. A lot of complexity there, of course, with what happened there. But with that, the whole timing issue and children being expected to perform in certain amounts of time, I think realistically there has to be some limit. And my question for you is, my challenge is, I have a third grader who is, she's bright and loves school, works very thoroughly, but is quite a dreamy child,
mm-hmm,
easily distracted. And as a parent, I've gotten the same message from every teacher over the years. We know she knows the information. You know, we just need to see her be more productive.
Mm-hmm.
And while I think that the general trend in schools, especially because of No Child Left Behind, is to rush kids, I do want to help her be realistic about accomplishing and being productive and getting to a point of completion. And so what can you say, or what do you have in your book that I can maybe go out and check out that speaks to the dreamy mind, or the mind that's easily distracted, where she's, you know, furiously working, and then suddenly she's, you know, in left field?
As we mentioned, one of the reasons why kids will have reduced output is because they may lack mental energy. and the mental energy to concentrate, to finish what you start, to be able to sustain your effort, is problematic for some children, and it sounds like that might be true of your daughter. She's having trouble mobilizing her attention, mm-hmm. focusing it and keeping it focused. Mm-hmm. And does she have any difficulty sleeping at night?
No.
Because some of these children do. Others just really need to get up and walk around. They need to take more frequent breaks. It's also important just to rule out the possibility that she may have some other kind of learning problem that's in the way.
Mm-hmm.
Even though she's very bright, she may have real trouble sort of expressing herself or getting her ideas out or organizing her thoughts. So at some point it might be good to have her evaluated to see where the obstruction is in her output. It can be a whole lot of different things. And sometimes distractibility is a trait that a child has, and other times kids become distracted because what they're doing feels too hard to them or they've run out of energy.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be worth looking into a little more.
Yeah, I think in some cases it actually, it both, challenging, but some of the work is maybe too rote,
uh-huh.
not challenging enough. Or,
yeah,
you know,
well, that's possible too.
He wants to be creative, and so but
a lot of kids who are who have
be
a lot of children who have that kind of distractibility and go off and daydream on what I call the free flight of ideas. They're often highly creative individuals, and you have to make sure she's having enough creative outlets
mm-hmm.
to keep strengthening that creativity.
Okay. And do you speak to that more in your book? I would like to find out more about how to, you know, just really how to approach it, because it is.
I think possibly my first of the two books I've done recently, A Mind at a Time, might be a bit more helpful to you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for the call. We have some others. The next would be in Chicago on our line four. Hello.
Hello, Doctor. You were mentioning earlier about how the chef had the ability to be organized at work, and then at home he was disorganized.
Right.
Wouldn't that be more based on the fact that he's plugging into the structure of the restaurant?
It's possible, but a lot of times he's responsible for creating that structure.
But coupled with incentive of making a living?
Yes, exactly. There's one other piece, though.
Yeah.
Which is that people can often improve their brain function when they find their niche. In other words, if there's an area that you have a real affinity for, a kind of domain that really resonates with your kind of mind, we find people can develop their language abilities, their organizational skills by focusing within the area that just sort of harmonizes beautifully with their kind of mind. And I've seen this. I've seen adults who are very verbal and expressive who never could talk well when they were kids. But they went into the computer field, they read a lot of computer manuals, they talked a lot of computer talk, and now they're writing poetry.
Well, it seems to me that if the person developed it in the chef, for instance,
yeah.
then eventually he could bring it home. But I think in a lot of cases it doesn't happen.
That's correct.
You know, because I really believe we're so incentive-based
mm-hmm.
that if there's no incentive to clean your own home or be organized in your own home, It kind of goes to the wayside.
Right. No, I think that's a factor. I think that has to be factored in.
And the other thing I was going to mention, you were talking about how we're basically taught to pass tests.
Uh-huh.
I think that's been going on for years. My sister was like a child genius, so to speak, and she could pass tests and memorize, and she can do every Jeopardy answer in the world, but functioning,
right.
never was taught to function. She was taught to pass tests.
Well, one thing I'm very interested in is the extent to which schools stress memory over understanding.
Right.
And there are kids who are valedictorians in their high school class because they have the best rote memory in the school. And when you grow up and get in a career, there's nothing more useless than rote memory.
And that's where the affirmation is based on.
That's right.
That's what the difficulty is. It kind of freezes the development of the person because you keep affirming only in one aspect of learning.
That's exactly right, and it's not a very important, especially nowadays. When your hard drive is on your desk, you don't need to be a great memorizer.
Right. So, okay. Well, thank you.
All right.
Thanks for the call.
We have about 15 minutes left in this, a little bit less in this part of Focus 580. Just wanted to introduce again our guest very quickly, Dr. Mel Levine. He's a pediatric, a pediatrician. He's professor of pediatrics at University of North Carolina Med School, and he's also director of the university's Clinical Center for the Study of Development and Learning, and has written a lot about learning and speaks on that all the time. He's become quite well known for that, and is the author of these two books that I've mentioned, The Myth of Laziness and One A Mind at a Time. And these books are both now out of paperback. They're published by Simon & Schuster. We'll go on to the next caller, and I believe that that person would be in Champaign. And no, I take that back. We'll go to Milwaukee for a caller here, line number 3. Hello.
Hi, I have a question. I have a 10-month-old baby that is breastfeeding, and she's still eating at night. Her father and I are getting divorced, and there is a court decision that she would spend one night a week at her father's. It's a temporary decision. I deeply disagree with it, and I believe that it's traumatizing to the baby because basically she's not sleeping all the night through, and she's still eating at night as well. So I'm wondering, what's your perspective on this?
I think I'm probably the wrong person to ask, and I think you should check with your own pediatrician who knows you and knows your baby really well. It's hard to generalize about these things. And also, the topic that I'm sort of involved with is with older children and their learning,
mm-hmm.
so it doesn't quite fit with your situation.
I see.
But I can certainly respect your desire to do what's right for your child, your baby.
Yeah, I'm afraid that that maybe is the best answer that we can give you, at least on this program today. We do have a monthly show that we do with a pediatrician that you might look for, but it's going to be a couple weeks since until we can do that again. Have you talked about it? Do you have your own pediatrician? Have you talked about it with your own doctor?
Yes.
And that hasn't been helpful?
No.
Hmm.
Do you see that as a long-term trauma to the baby?
Not necessarily. Again, I think it's important to look at the whole situation, and somebody who knows you well and knows the baby and the whole situation, I think, could probably evaluate it better than I can on a radio show.
Yeah. I'm afraid that's probably about the best we can do. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry too.
It's really hard to, we have physicians on the program, people who come from different disciplines. And one of the things that I always say is that we hope people can understand we can't do diagnosis over the telephone.
Right.
And we do shows like these because we hope that they will add to people's knowledge. And it is a place that they can ask questions, but there are always limits. And that's, I think, the crucial factor. You know, there's only so much personal information you can solicit in a format like this, and it makes it really tough. That and, of course, all guests can't be experts on everything. So I'm sorry. I think that's probably about the best we can do for the caller. Well, we have other people here. Let's go on, and the next is going to be Urbana and line number 1. Hello.
Hi. Very interested in your program. I just wanted to say about this whole business of No Child Left Behind and so forth, and an interesting insight from a local school board member who said that in the state of Illinois, there are no standards for homeschooled children. And if there's a problem with truancy, all the parent has to do is say, oh, I'm going to homeschool, and they can't enforce school attendance. So there's a whole issue in here about, in terms of learning and standards that we're not addressing. I just wanted to toss it out as just another piece of information to add to what you're saying before. Thanks so much.
That's an interesting point. Thank you.
All right. We'll go on to Savoy. That's the next caller, line 2. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I may have missed this in the discussion. I've been in and out of the car doing errands. I really appreciate what you're saying in your program, and as the parent of a very bright child whose kid was taught cookie-cutter method for the first 2 years and 2 months he was in school, I, again, appreciate what you're saying. Do you see a movement, education being the most studied system, so I've heard, in the United States, of wholesale, of people looking at this and saying, okay, this is what we need to do, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
I believe there is a strong trend in this direction, recognizing that one size doesn't fit all when it comes to education, that we have to treat different kids somewhat differently, that different children have different profiles of strengths and weaknesses, different ways of learning, and that we can recognize this. It's not an overwhelming problem to recognize it. I run an institute, a nonprofit institute called All Kinds of Minds, and one of the programs within that institute is called Schools Attuned, where we train teachers around the country to understand these differences in learning, understand children's strengths as well as their weaknesses, and it really pertains to all kids, not just a small population of them. And we find that the teachers are becoming increasingly interested in the variations between their students, the different patterns of wiring they're likely to encounter in a classroom. And teachers are telling us that by understanding this, it's making their job easier. They have fewer behavior problems. The kids are much more readily teachable when people do understand these variations, when they understand that there's a particular child who probably should print instead of doing cursive writing, when there's another kid who has memory problems, so you shouldn't surprise him and call on him in class, but maybe warn him the day before that you're going to call on him tomorrow. So there are a lot of things that teachers can do that are actually going to make their lives easier when they recognize the differences that exist across a classroom, and we're finding this is gaining widespread acceptance. Hmm.
And maybe I'd mention again, if people are interested in learning more about All Kinds of Minds, then they do, and if they have internet access, there is a website
yes.
that people can look at, which is www.allkindsofminds, that's as one word, no spaces yes. between there, allkindsofminds.org, and they can find out what it's all about.
Absolutely.
You know, it occurs to me, based on the wide range of comments and questions we had this morning, that there are probably a lot of parents who have questions, a lot of different kind of questions, and they don't know where to go. They don't know who to ask. I wonder if indeed you think that that is a problem, and how parents can even think about approaching the subject of where do I find the person to ask this question that I have?
It's a huge problem because a lot of times these people aren't where you think they are, and they're not who you think they are. Obviously, you have to start with the school, but I think you have to be a wise consumer of advice from the school. And I think parents almost have to educate themselves to a large extent, just as if you were going to go buy a new car and you decided you were going to check out Consumer Reports and some other car reviews before doing it. I think parents have to do some reading up on kids' minds and become more knowledgeable so they can ask the right questions and evaluate the answers. And there are people in the schools who can provide really interesting and useful information on how your child learns if you ask the right questions, if you ask well. There are also sometimes psychologists or special educators who practice out in the community who can be very helpful to you. But again, you have to ask good questions. And in my opinion, and this is only my opinion, when you ask it, you should say, please don't give me any labels for my child. If you could be more specific, I would appreciate it. Tell me exactly what gets in the way when she tries to write or when she tries to pay attention. And I think you can come up with good answers. You also should ask other parents whose kids have been struggling to identify people in the community who have really been helpful and the people who just haven't been helpful.
We're coming down to the point here. We just have maybe about 3 minutes, and unfortunately not enough time to get into the subject that I'm going to raise right now, but I guess I want to do that at least for a couple of minutes because it is the subject of a lot of controversy, and that is the use of medication
right.
in children, particularly kids who have been identified as having some kind of attention problem.
Right.
Some people think that it's terrible. Some people would say that it achieved miraculous results for their children, and it was very successful, and it made all the difference in the world.
Right.
How do you approach that?
Well, as usual, the answer is somewhat in between. I consider myself on the conservative side when it comes to medication, but I'm not opposed to using medication either. And there are some children who can benefit a lot, especially those who are struggling with their attention. Can benefit a fair amount from the use of medication, but it's never the whole story. It's never the final answer. So I think it has to be used carefully, in appropriate doses, and for as short a time as we can use it and get away with it. I also should mention to you that it's very rare for a kid to have attention deficits and nothing else. Almost every kid who's having trouble with attention has a little cluster of dysfunctions, maybe trouble with attention plus language plus memory, or attention plus social skills plus sequencing things. And so we always have to define the whole cluster before you just throw a kid on medication. because you might be missing something that's really going to gnaw away at that child's learning and self-esteem over time, and you're kind of half covering it up with the medication. So I don't think any kid should be put on medication until he's been evaluated thoroughly, and we should never expect medicine to be the magic bullet to sort of take care of everything.
Well, there I think that we will leave it with, again, a mention that if you'd like to read more on this subject, you can look for these books that we've talked about, Myth of Laziness and Mind at a Time. They're now in paperback, published by Simon & Schuster. By our guest, Mel Levine. He's professor of pediatrics, University of North Carolina Med School. And again, if you're interested in all kinds of minds and you have access to the Internet, you can go to that website, which is www.allkindsofminds.org. And to you, Dr. Levine, thanks once again for being with us.
Thank you very much, David.